A fine piece of work from the group First Call. I sing the mighty power of God. Also heard from Rob and Mark, You're the Lion of Judah. 13 minutes after the hour, it's Tuesday, and we welcome Dr. Don Clark from Creation Moments. Dr. Don down in Garden Valley, Texas this morning at home on the winery. And I don't know what a vigneron does during the month of January. Do you look at catalogs, Don, and order new grapes, or what do you do in January?
Well, it's you start to take care of your trellis again, yeah. Kind of repair and tight.
Oh, we're getting some intermittent communications here. This could be a problem today.
I was having some incoming interruptions, so I'm not exactly sure what the heck's going on.
Okay. Well, anyway, it's a busy time of the year. You always got the maintenance work out there. In addition to being a biochemist and a member of the board at Creation Moments, Dr. Don is one of the, I want to say preeminent, but maybe one of the primal, better word. vignerons. That means you grow grapes, right? When you're a vigneron, and you're a vintner, yes, when you make wine from them. So, okay,
that's correct.
Okay, mm-hmm. Yep. All right,
and all correct.
And we,
I
often,
think mostly from what I've heard, mostly vignerons in January pace a lot.
No,
they walk back and forth and think about what they've got to be worried about next month.
I imagine. Will it be Japanese beetles this year, or will it be the wild pigs that will get me?
Well, hopefully we've solved the pig problem.
No,
with our fence, and once we got the fence extended to far enough into the pond, it didn't seem like we had any more visitors.
Okay, do you have like raccoons? I mean, up here they would.
Don't say that. Oh. Don't say that. just don't say.
Apparently they do. I just wondering from what direction the threat will come this year.
But we have raccoons. But
no,
I don't think they found the vineyard yet.
Okay, well that's a good thing. That's a good thing. Dr. Don, there's an award out there from the Creation Science Hall of Fame. And it's recently been awarded to, it's called the Gish Morris Whitcomb Award, and it's awarded to the creationist who has made outstanding contributions to creation science in a given year. Now, we make a big deal out of the book of Genesis here, and we believe in Scripture, and we believe it's a good indicator, that is literal, it tells us what happened, but still we look constantly for scientific evidence, that is, rational conclusions outside the Bible that will also point to the same thing, because that's evidence. That's you're looking for the weight of the evidence, and sometimes that's what it takes to get a non-believer or an evolutionist interested. They've got to hear the young Earth creation science, and there is science on that side of the argument, isn't there, Don?
Well, there's quite a bit of science, as a matter of fact, and there's a lot of very intelligent people thinking about the problems, how we can reconcile what the Bible says, that we've got a young Earth and a young universe, and the evidence that we see, for example, of everything around us, not only here on Earth but out in the cosmos, and how do we pull all these things together and make sense of it.
Well, Dr. Brown has a book, Dr. Walter Brown. The book is In the Beginning, Compelling Evidence for Creation and the Flood. Now, the book was Dr. Brown and his book won the award. The book's been around for a couple of years, hasn't it? Are you familiar with it?
Well, I am familiar with it a little bit. I haven't read it. I was taking a look at a little bit of the contents last night. Mm-hmm. It was quite a controversial book because of some of the things that he was suggesting or theorizing that possibly could have happened, mm-hmm, at the time of the flood, and I think it was it's in the eighth edition, so it's probably been around since the early 2000,
mm-hmm, that would
maybe
sense.
Even before that,
mm-hmm,
but so it's interesting though that one of the things that he had predicted was this business of Comet having at least twice as much deuterium in their water as we do here on Earth. And he gives a very rational explanation as to why that would be the case.
Mm-hmm.
And one theory, of course, the traditional theory of how the water got here, you know, from first you know, on Earth, was being bombarded by comets. So comets containing a lot of water, you know, were hitting the Earth, and that provided the water. Well, if the concentration of deuterium isn't the same, if you analyze it from a comet and what you analyze on Earth, then you've got a problem.
Mm-hmm. Which we weren't able to do until this past year, correct?
That is correct. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the reasons why Dr. Brown actually, Walter Brown actually got this award, because he was one, if not the only creationist that was purporting a mechanism for and saying that, you know, if you ever analyze the water on a comet, it's going to have more deuterium than we have here on Earth. And that's exactly what was found. They found that when a probe, the Rosetta Philae mission, sent a probe to comet 67P, they found that it had three times as much deuterium in the water from the comet than we have here on Earth. So the theory that the comets actually, you know, bombarded the Earth, and that's what caused the water, you know, on the Earth, was totally busted, because it's, you know, we should have at least the same amount of deuterium here on Earth as in the comet.
Mm-hmm.
But Dr. Brown actually postulated that one of the reasons for the flood was a bombardment of the planet by neutrons. And that then, I mean, the difference between, let's say, hydrogen that we know of in deuterium is that deuterium has an extra neutron.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There was silence. So
yeah,
I
don't know I'm listening intensely.
Okay. So. The question then came from, okay, if one of the causes of the flood is a bombardment of neutrons, and that was in the upper crust of the Earth, then that would have caused a heating up of the Earth's surface and an ejection of bodies, you know, from the Earth, the ejection of water, icy materials that we now call, you know, comets, as well as other type of astronomical bodies.
Now you're saying these neutrons would have come from, are you saying like a shell around the Earth when you say upper crust? Are you talking about the land mass itself? Or do these neutrons come from outer space?
Well, the neutrons would have come from outer space.
Okay, gotcha.
Now, what caused a bombardment of neutrons? Did a neutron star explode near the Earth, for example? I mean, relatively near the Earth. If it exploded too close to the Earth, it would have wiped it out. But mm-hmm. And so there was a neutron, you know, bombardment. You know, we don't know. Mm-hmm. But
can the sun do that? Could the sun be responsible?
I don't know. That's a good question. If there was a big solar flare, I don't think that neutrons are necessarily shot out from from the sun.
Okay.
But
something, you know, he's theorizing now. At some point there was a neutron beam, a bunch of I don't know what you a herd of neutrons. aimed at the Earth, yeah.
A shower of
neutrons.
There you
go, a neutron shower. Thank you.
Yeah, hit the Earth. Well, if that was indeed so, then the water on the surface of the earth and in the oceans at that time would have been enriched. The hydrogen of the water would have been enriched with neutrons, changing the hydrogen into deuterium.
Aha. Okay.
And then if the Earth, ejected this material out into space, then that would explain the comets. And this is indeed what he believed, was that the material was injected out into space, so the comets that we see today came from the Earth and not the other way around.
Interesting.
Which is 180 degrees out of phase with standard thinking. So he was ridiculed quite a bit, for this theory, as you can imagine. It said, you got to be crazy to even, contemplate that. But part of his theory was that, as much as 3% of the Earth's mass could have been ejected at the time of the flood. And that in itself is an amazing thing to even think about. How could anybody survive? Well, the only people that survived were those that were on the ark, of course, and the animals that were on the ark. And it just goes to show you how violent, how violent that episode was, the global flood, was back then, in the time of Noah. What a wonderful and great God that we have, that God, warned people that a catastrophe was coming. Matter of fact, he warned them for, 100 to almost 120 years. And then he really warned them like 7 days before the flood, because there was all kinds of earth movements that were taking place at the time. And still, people, because of their hardness of heart and their evilness that were in them, refused to believe. And so finally, obviously, God closed the door on the ark, and pretty much it was chaos after that. But the ark was built in such a way to withstand this violent activity that was going on. I mean, can you imagine 3% of the earth, not a third, but a 3% of the earth, being injected during that time, how violent the surface of the earth would have been. And the ark, had to survive that. It also explains, all of the material that was obviously thrown up into the upper atmosphere of the Earth, which obviously could account for the ice age that we know it, and the blocking of the sun's energy, and sun's rays around the Earth, which would cause a great cooling of the Earth's surface. While the waters were still warm and the waters pumping up water into the atmosphere. So it's an interesting, very interesting model, and I'm going to take some more time and actually read his book, and then we can probably have a more detailed discussion of
I think exactly I'm going to do the same thing. I'm reading this commentary on the award that was presented to Dr. Brown this year, and it's talking about a secular astronomer who has noted the orbits of some dwarf planets, which are, now I'm trying to interpret this, they're talking about trans-Neptunian objects, or TNOs, which means, I guess, they're beyond the orbit of Neptune, farther out than that. But they have similarities in their orbits that suggest maybe a common point of origin. And so there's an entirely different set of findings here that tend to support Dr. Brown's theory, that it came from the Earth. Not only comets and meteorites, but dwarf planets as well. So it's like all the flotsam and jetsam out there may have originated right here with the Earth, correct?
Well, that's exactly what it appears is the case indeed, that these trans-Neptunian objects and possibly even other objects that either orbit the Earth from, they have tremendous orbits like some of the comets do, or some of these other bodies that you know, are lining up and are clearly, you know, kind of pointing in the direction of the sun and could be pointing in the direction of Earth at a certain time when the mm-hmm. Earth's, you know, orbit is, you know, in the right location.
Interesting, too, about the time differential here between the creation and the time of the flood, because one of the findings of that European probe to the comet was that there is water being ejected from this comet at a certain rate. They were able to measure the rate. And the old theory that the comet may have been around since the creation was kind of thrown out the window as well, because the water would have been long gone if it's been around for billions of years. It is apparently much newer than what those scientists had projected to be the date of creation. In other words, there's not enough water in this comet to have lasted that long to be ejected at the same rate that we currently observe it, that we have now scientifically measured it, which speaks to a young Earth, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And not only a young Earth, a young universe, because mm-hmm. They were thinking, okay, these comets got to be billions of years old, just like the rest of the universe. And this particular comet had 101 geysers on it, you know, just spewing out water and ice. Mm-hmm. And obviously a lot of it is escaping into space. And how could that continually do that, you know, for millions of years, much less billions of mm-hmm. years? And so, yes, it all points to not only a young Earth, but a young universe, and also supports that, hey, you know, maybe that comet is, you know, about 4,400 years old, because that was about the time of the flood.
Mm-hmm.
And that would make a whole lot of sense, because you would still have quite a bit of, you know, water around if it's only, you know, less than 5,000 years, you know, old, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So there are, you know, many, many findings that we had last year in many different areas that point to, you know, point to a young Earth and point to a young universe. And it seems like, you know, everywhere you're turning, whether it's way out in space or you're looking down at the, you know, at our DNA, or the DNA of some organism, and you're coming up with the same, you know, conclusion that, hey, not only is everything designed, but it's a lot younger than we thought it was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And one of the key findings has to do with all this water that's locked up in minerals within the Earth, too. Now, again, reading from this article over at the Creation Science Hall of Fame website, they're talking about the Isaac Newton veil canopy theory of the global flood. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't this where Newton had projected or surmised that there was probably a layer of moisture around the Earth that would have accounted for all the water necessary to create a global flood? And I wasn't aware before that Newton had come up with that idea, but the veil canopy theory of the global flood was from Isaac Newton. But Dr. Brown said the idea of the clouds holding as much water as must have fallen to the Earth was simply not reasonable. And since then, we found indications of a whole lot of water locked up in minerals within the Earth. And of course, Genesis talks about the what's the phrasing in Genesis? The water from deep within, the fountains from within, or the water from within the Earth?
Waters from the deep. Yeah. Yeah, the waters from the deep breaking forth, you know, at the time of the flood.
Mm-hmm.
And we really, you know, need, when you're reading Scripture, this is how I like to read Scripture, and, you know, take it for what it says. Mm-hmm. And if it says that the waters from the deep came forth, maybe we should investigate how that could have possibly happened. Of course, you know, it rained for, you know, 40 days and 40 nights. But the concept that there was this cloud moisture, you know, around the globe, around the earth that held so much water that it rained, you know, it could continue to rain for that period of time. And what was holding it there in the first place, and there are some theories, there's a canopy, ice canopy theory, by Dr. Carl Baugh, mm-hmm. for example, here in Texas, that suggests that there was a ice bilayer completely around the earth, and maybe that's where all the water came from. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe most of the water came from the deep, and the water raining for 40 days and 40 nights was actually spewed up into the atmosphere as a result of this neutron bombardment that Dr. Brown talks about. Well, that's totally different. That means that we don't have a canopy at all. Or at least not like some of these other folks had thought, but that the water actually originated from Earth at the time of the flood, and we just didn't understand perhaps the mechanism. Mm-hmm. But, Dr. Brown certainly, he has, I'm interested in reading the book to find out what his thinking is, for example, as to where the neutrinos, where the neutrons came from, for example, and how that, did it come from one side of the Earth, or was it for a period of time that the Earth was bombarded with these neutrinos, and what was happening to poor, Noah and his family, during this whole time of neutron bombardment, because that would have been the neutrons would have gotten, stopped by the wooden arc, and probably by the pitch, in the arc. Which is an interesting thing in its, in itself, mm-hmm. That God would tell, Noah to design such a structure that would not only protect them from the violent seas that was coming, but also from, cosmic radiation that was coming from the outside, as well.
Well, would pitch block cosmic radiation then? Because he said to code it within and without, inside and outside.
Well, neutrons are big particles. I mean, they're, it's the size of a proton. There's the only difference between a neutron and a proton is that a neutron doesn't have a positive charge on it. So that they're very similar in size. And that would be, that would be blocked pretty easily. Unlike neutrinos, which can go right through the Earth, for example, mm-hmm. Which are very, very, very tiny, very high energy, particles. So depending in gamma rays, would penetrate pretty deeply. But something like a beta ray, which is an electron, beta particles, don't go very deep because they get trapped and captured pretty easily. That would be the same thing with neutrons, although neutrons not having a positive charge, mm-hmm. could go a little deeper.
Well, we're human beings. If animal existence was beamed with neutrons, would that be harmful to them?
I would think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you're changing, if you're changing the water that would be in you, for example, from just hydrogen into deuterium, mm-hmm. While and possibly even in tritium, if you had enough exposure to it, that in itself wouldn't necessarily be catastrophic, if you had a large percentage of your hydrogen changing into deuterium, that might be a problem for you.
I do remember military research back 20 or 30 years ago, and I haven't heard much about this in recent years, but neutron bombs were being researched, and the thought being behind a neutron bomb is it would be used tactically in combat. It would be launched by shorter range weapons because it's clean. It would burst, and there would be no residual radiation. But what it would do is destroy all living creatures, plant and animal, while leaving physical buildings and structures untouched. And so it was considered a dastardly kind of weapon, and there was a lot of protest and anger at the thought that we would even consider using that. But enough research had been done on neutron bombs that apparently established that it would it would mean death for living beings, but not so much for physical structures, not for mountains and for buildings and for non-organic matter.
Well, that's an interesting point, and that probably, depending on the intensity of this bombardment, I mean, assuming that Dr. Brown's theory is correct, I would think it would be pretty deleterious to someone's health to be bombarded with neutrons, especially for any length of time, and if you couldn't hide into something, something. You certainly would have a problem. I would think.
Oh, we talked about hiding. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, while we were talking, I'm thinking of the scene as the flood begins in Noah, the movie Noah, where a lot of the water comes from the earth, comes from the ground, and geysers pop up all over the place. And that's the kind of image that's going through my mind as we're talking about this subject. Is that a fairly accurate depiction of what you're talking about?
Well, it's certainly that particular point, because that movie was horrible and not accurate at all to what the Bible would say. But that's that could very well that. There's obviously a lot of water did come up from from the deep, and it probably was pretty violent. And if Dr. Brown's theory of the neutron storm, then that would have caused geysers and all kinds of things. I mean, we think that there's Old Faithful doing it again. Well, of course, that's heated up by the molten material under the earth and water, coming in contact or close contact with it. And then it periodically shoots out its steam and its hot water.
And again, I'm sure that the makers of the movie had read Genesis and saw that. And that's how they pictured that happening, I guess, the waters from the deep coming up. So there are other discoveries. We haven't gotten to all of them, but I think we can do that maybe next week. There's kind of a recap over at the Institute of Creation Research on some of the recent discoveries that support a young Earth creationist position. And it makes for fascinating reading and fascinating discussion, too. And that's what we take great delight in, having Dr. Don visit and bring these things to us. We'll take a look at some of that next week. And Don, it's January. I'll let you go back to your grape catalogs, and
kind of. Well, yeah, there's you don't have grape catalogs.
No,
you do have
no.
Nurseries that advertise, not advertise, but you can go on their websites and say, okay, what vines do they have available?
I'm just thinking up here in the North Country, this is the time of the year when people look longingly at those seed catalogs, and they thumb through them and they contemplate putting them into that warm earth that will reappear sometime, hopefully at least, in the not too distant future. Dr. Don Clark, a biochemist, member of the Board of Creation Moments, heartily recommend that you visit their website, creationmoments.com. You can link to them from our site at brokenroadradio.com. Also at brokenroadradio.com, you can have access to a whole library of conversations with Dr. Don over the past 3 years. And most all of it has, some of it has to do with silly stuff, but most of it's a young Earth creationism. I think you'll find it fascinating. Don, thanks so much for being here. Appreciate your visit today.
Okay, well, it's been fun as usual, and we'll see you next week.
Okay, I look forward to that.
See you, Don.
Okay, so long.